Hello and welcome to the EdSurge podcast, where every week we look at the future of learning. I'm Jeff Young. I'm an editor and a reporter here at EdSurge. As I talk to teachers and professors these days, many are telling me about the sinking feeling that they're getting as they're reading student assignments. The phrases and the passages in these essays, they just don't sound right. And they definitely don't sound like the work of the students that they know. As one longtime instructor told me recently, the sentences are framed correctly, but it ends up being gibberish. These instructors suspect that the students are using ChatGPT or some other AI chatbot, essentially having a robot write their papers for them. And many teachers in this situation have started using AI detectors to check these essays. The idea is that the detectors are supposed to flag if something is bot written. That approach is controversial, though, since these AI detectors have been shown to sometimes return false positives, asserting in some cases that the text is AI generated, even if the student did all the work themselves without any chatbot assistance. And these false positives, they seem to happen more frequently with students who don't speak English as their first language. So some instructors are trying a totally different approach to guard against AI cheating. And it's one that borrows a page out of criminal investigations. It's called linguistic fingerprinting, where linguistic techniques are used to determine whether a text has been written by a specific person based on an analysis of that person's writings. The technology helped catch Ted Kaczynski, the terrorist known as the Unabomber, who you may remember years ago as having a deadly series of mail bombs. And an analysis of Kaczynski's 35,000-word anti-technology manifesto was matched to his previous writings to help identify him. For today's podcast, we're talking with someone who has tried linguistic fingerprinting in his classes. His name is Mike Kentz. He's an English teacher at Benedictine Military School in Savannah, Georgia. And he also writes a Substack newsletter about AI issues in education. He argues that the approach flips the script on the usual way to check for AI, or plagiarism. I started by asking Mike, what is a linguistic fingerprint?
Yeah, well, it's a lot like a regular fingerprint, except it has to do with the way that we speak and the way that we write, more the way that we write. And it's the idea that, you know, we have a unique way of communicating that can be patterned, it can be tracked, it can be identified. And the idea is that if you have a known document written by somebody, usually the more the better, but in general terms, if you have a known document written by somebody, you can kind of pattern their fingerprint. And what that means for our purposes in education is that if a student does write something that, and I'll choose my words carefully here, doesn't look like it was written by them, and I'm being careful here, not, you know, forget AI, was it written by them? You can run that newer essay or whatever written assignment you have against the original fingerprint and see whether or not the linguistic style matches, the syntax, the word choice, the stop word frequency, lexical density, all types of very, very, you know, in the weeds approach towards understanding linguistics. I'm not a linguist by trade at all, but I stumbled on this maybe 6 or 7 months ago, and I've used it 2 or 3 times, and it's been helpful as a backbone, as sort of a backup in these situations where we're not really sure. Was AI used? Was this, how much was it used? How similar is this actually to the student's writing?
Yeah, well, I want to actually like stretch this out because I think that there's a lot to unpack in what you've just said. So maybe if we could start for a minute about just conceptually, what's wrong with the idea of a teacher using an AI detector? You know, in the past, if you had an academic integrity situation in a writing class, whether it's school or college, you would say, you know, it's been a thing with plagiarism detection software. It's become so routine now. Now, of course, a few years when it first started, people had all kinds of questions about it. But it's become kind of the status quo to say, okay, there are these plagiarism detection tools like Turnitin.com, and a lot of schools and colleges have the subscription to them, so it's available to teachers. And the idea has been like check to see if this was copied. And so what I've been seeing with AI tools like ChatGPT is a similar idea being used with AI detectors. These tools, some of them are even free. Some of them are produced by the same people who made the like plagiarism detectors like Turnitin. And the idea is, let's just take the same playbook and say, let's see if it's AI written by using, let's see if it's AI generated by using this chatbot detector. And so instead of, you know, raw plagiarism, it's a detector, but it's really the same conceptual framework, I think. What's wrong with just carrying that, you know, technique forward into your writing classes and just use an AI detector?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I would start by saying that we are living in what some people call a post-plagiarism era, where plagiarism really isn't going to be a thing anymore, because people are not going to go to the students or people in general are not going to go to the internet for information and copy and paste it and pretend that it's their own. They're just going to ask AI to generate some stuff, and then they're going to copy and paste that and use that. And where it gets really, really interesting is when you think about what AI is actually doing, and you consider, if we're going to try to detect, we need to think about what AI is producing. And the reason why AI detection softwares, in practice, we've used them at our school and they have not been successful, don't work, is because AI is, if you ask the same question three times in a row to the same AI bot or a different AI bot, it's going to produce something different every single time.
Right. If people haven't used it, you go to ChatGPT and you type in, you know, requests, it's going to come up with a sentence. Like, even if you say, like, give me a very specific prompt, and then the next time you do it, it won't give you that exact same prompt, or the answer rather. It's going to come up with different words.
Exactly. And so that gets into a really interesting debate or question around, you know, because people will say, well, is AI plagiarizing the internet? Is it plagiarizing other authors who have written? And that's sort of a separate conversation. But the point is, it's not producing, it's not copying and pasting itself. It's producing something new every single time. And so what are you actually detecting when you're using software that's supposedly going to identify if AI has written it? I don't know. I don't know what you could possibly detect other than perhaps robotic writing styles. And we had a situation 2 years ago where our valedictorian, who's an incredible writer, he wrote a paper, and our teacher put all of the papers for that particular class through an AI detection software program, and his came back as being AI written. And we're talking about a kid who's like an Eagle Scout, and like we were able to, you know, confirm that it was not AI written at all. And so that is, to me, a very a strong example of where it can really fall short, because what's it actually detecting? And you can't identify if something is AI or not, because it's different every single time.
It's interesting. And there are these false positives that we've seen even in, you know, research projects where they absolutely knew that this was written by a human and there was no question there, and that the bot said, or the detector said, this is a bot written. And so like you had a relationship with this student, you knew that the student was telling the truth. And so there are these situations that come up, and I hear about them, you know, all over the place. And in fact, I think some of the detector makers have said they have a 1-2% at least kind of false positive rate, which, you know, can, if you multiply that over their thousands and tens of thousands of students, that turns into real people being impacted.
Absolutely. And I was actually talking with some students today about it, and you know, they were saying, well, maybe it can work because it detects, again, we're kind of sort of talking about this robotic writing style and the particular way that AI seems to write, which is sort of almost not human because it's so good. But I pointed out to them, and I would point out to everybody else, I can ask ChatGPT to write like a third grader too, you know?
Or like a robot,
or write like me, or, you know, write like a fifth grader or whoever, you know, write. And it's just so... The idea of AI detection actually signifies somewhat of a fundamental misconception about what AI is. And I do think there's been a pretty strong push. I've been talking with a lot of people who we've been collating the research. There's quite a lot of research out there about how AI detection softwares, again, like you said, they can produce so many false positives, and they really are not something that we want to build the foundation of the next education system on, because it's a software that is unlikely to be very, very successful. So that's where I come from with this flipping the script idea, is we have to get a little bit more creative now, because we can't use plagiarism detectors anymore. It's just not going to work.
Okay. Now, of course, the the plagiarism detection folks, you know, kind of make their case that they're valid. But I'm interested in this counter idea. So flipping the script, how did you first stumble upon this idea of linguistic fingerprints?
I went to the NCTE conference.
This is the writer teacher group. Yes.
Yeah, National Council of Teachers of English. I went to it in November and I saw a couple of different presentations on ChatGPT and AI in general. And one particular panel, I ended up kind of engaging with the folks afterwards and they said, well, there's this idea, linguistic fingerprinting. And on the back of that, I just reached out to one of the particular companies that's doing this. And they said, hey, listen, you can run a free trial. They sort of explained it to me. And based on their explanation, my thought was, you know, why would I not run a couple of tests on this? Why would I not try this? Because it also, when it produces a report, it's not saying, yes, this kid wrote this, this student wrote this, or no, the student did not write it. It's on a spectrum. And there's tons of vectors inside the system that are all on a sort of pendulum, I guess you could say. So it's going to give you a percentage likelihood that that student for the second paper also wrote, you know, the first one. And so, yeah. So from there, I've run it a couple of times, and it's been helpful a few times. Yeah.
So the metaphor, it's interesting because this technique, you know, of linguistic fingerprints, it absolutely predates AI and generative AI, predates generative AI. And one of the things that I understand is that some very famous criminal trials have hinged on these kind of tools of like trying to detect the provenance of a piece of writing, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The most famous is the Ted Kaczynski Unabomber trial. And I'm not a historian on that particular subject, but I've read about it a little bit. And from what I understand, you know, he was writing letters and had written many in the past. And the FBI had a sort of a universe of writing that they could kind of match and try to figure it out. And they used this same approach of linguistic fingerprinting, also known, by the way, as authorship determination, to sort of reverse engineer the identification process and say, okay, they got it down to three people and Ted Kaczynski was one of them. And then ultimately they caught him that way. And then I don't know if you've read, but there, when J.K. Rowling wrote her, she wrote a crime drama under a pseudonym, and they used this same approach to figure out who the writer was. And they figured out that it was her based on, and eventually she admitted it, that based on all of her past writing, that this new, which by the way, completely different genre, think about that, completely different genre. And this system was able to match her new writing with her old writing.
Harry Potter author, that it's a little bit like magic caught her, but it feels like magic, but it's not, it's science.
Right. And I think that your point, I try to stress that when I talk to people, because they go, well, AI detection doesn't work. AI detection work. And I go, well, that's the beauty of this. This is not AI detection, right? We're just trying to determine whether or not the student wrote it. And this has existed for quite a while. So that, I hope, you know, rings a bell in people's minds or raises, you know, okay, this is a little bit different than what I'm used to hearing about.
Yeah. And so I worked as a bank teller one summer when I was in college. And at the time they had to do a fingerprint me in case I ran off so that I'm on record somewhere. And if later on my actual fingerprint, you know, could be matched if something went awry. And that hasn't been referenced to my knowledge, but you know, I'm okay. But it's interesting that the idea of teachers employing this in a classroom, there is this moment where you're sort of asking at the beginning of a class, it sounds like, for the students to kind of give give their fingerprint, in this case by writing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think that's where things will get tricky in the future. Now, in my case, at the beginning of this year, in August of 2023, most of my students, I teach freshman high school English at a Catholic school in Savannah. And most of my students at that point in August 2023 were not using AI at all. And so I had all these writing samples in the first couple of months of school that I was very confident were written by my students. And so I didn't have to do this known document thing. Now, coming into next year, I think we're going to have a very different situation. I think the adoption of AI by students has increased tenfold. I think that's partially a result of social media companies embedding AI into their search functions like Snapchat and Instagram. And so kids are getting really much, they're getting used to it very, very quickly, and they don't see a problem with it. And you know, I don't necessarily blame them. If I were their age, I'd be doing the same thing. So, but to your point, what I think I will have to do next year is you can do this in one or two or three ways. One, if you wanted to do like the whole school, for example, one idea is to cut off the Wi-Fi. And it's to say, all right, everybody's doing a writing sample from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on, you know, the third Monday of school or something like that. And we're just going to cut off Wi-Fi. And that way we know for a fact everything you wrote, and we'll give them the materials, right? You give them a prompt.
Put your phone away. There's no way that you went to ChatGPT or anything like it. Yeah.
And then you turn it back on. Okay. Submit it. Okay. So now I've got this universe of files that I know, are trusted known documents. Now, if you don't want to be that intense, you know, you could do it on a class by class basis and just monitor really closely. There's a platform that we use called Do You Know, where you can actually monitor kids' screens from your own screen. So you could sit there and just do it on a class by class basis. If you're just a teacher like me and you're not doing it on a system wide basis, and you same thing, you know, writing sample for the next hour, and then you're going to turn it in, and that's my known document. Now, the where you know it's kind of a controversial thing though, because a lot of people talk about, you know, we shouldn't turn this into like a cops and robbers kind of thing. We don't want to treat our kids like they're, you know, soon to be criminals who are definitely going to cheat. And I don't disagree. I mean, it definitely, if I have to have that conversation next year, which I sort of plan on doing, it will be sensitive. I'm going to have to say, hey, listen, this isn't because I don't trust you. It's just because I want to have backup and I want to know what your writing looks like without a doubt. And it's, you know, it's not personal. Please don't take it personal. I just want to know what your writing looks like. And then if something does happen, we'll have this system that will help us out. And then on the back of that, I have heard other people, including my students, have said to me, well, that feels kind of unfair. You know, I had students say to me this morning, they said, well, my writing changes pretty dramatically from history class to science class to English class, depending on what I'm writing. The style is so different. And then other times I put a lot of effort into my, you know, this particular essay because it was for whatever reason I needed to. And this one I kind of shortchanged because I didn't have time. And so the style is going to be so different. And then someone's going to say I used AI for the good one. And I get those fears. But I think if people were to see the reports that I've seen, they are so dense and they are so very thorough that we're not talking about a situation where a mild change is going to raise this huge red flag. And furthermore, I don't view this approach as a first line of defense. I view it as a last line of defense. You know, if I have a situation next year where I think a kid may have used AI, I am not going to immediately go do the fingerprinting process. That's not going to be the first thing I do. You know, I'll have a conversation with them first. Hopefully there's enough trust there and we can kind of talk it out and figure it out. And there's other steps you can take along the way. But this, I think, is just a nice sort of catch-all at the end. It's a nice backup in the case that you do have kind of, and I think schools are going to have a big problem next year where there's lots of conflicts between students and teachers, where a student says, yeah, I used it, but it's still my work. And the teacher goes, I don't care. Or like, you used it too much. And then what's too much and what's too little?
No, it's so interesting. So it's almost like, since it is a tool that originated in law enforcement has used it, it does raise these things that, and really plagiarism detection software was already raising that debate. But here we have it very explicitly coming from law enforcement. I'm interested to hear what you're saying is, in a way, like, teachers could give like a polygraph test to a student in such a situation, but you wouldn't necessarily do that. How is this different, I wonder?
You know, that's actually a really good point. I mean, one of my responses to that kind of question when people say, well, we should, well, hold on a second. I mean, school, you have to have a system of rewards and consequences in a school. And you have to have a system for enforcing rules and disciplining kids if they step out of line. For example, cameras in the hallways, right? I mean, we do that to make sure that we have documented evidence in case something goes down. And we have all kinds of disciplinary measures that are backed up by mechanisms to make sure that that actually gets held up. So, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, we shouldn't be giving our kids polygraphs, but also it's the nature of school that we have a disciplinary system and we have mechanisms to enforce that disciplinary system. Now, maybe you don't want to go this far, and I totally understand that, right? Like, maybe that's just feels weird to you. Some people would say cameras in the hallways feels weird to them, right? It's more a matter of what you're used to or whether or not the problem is big enough. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. If it gets to a point where you need something, you know, you might change your tune and you might feel like, you know, I'm exaggerating, but maybe I do want to give a polygraph, right? I don't think that will happen, but my point is, schools have always had disciplinary measures and they've always had mechanisms to enforce those disciplinary measures. The question of whether or not your appetite allows you to use this type of one, I think that's a personal choice. I don't think it has to be a uniform thing. I think it's just an option if you're, again, in a situation where you feel like you need something.
It's so interesting, and I'm always interested in these metaphors. I appreciated your comparisons between the cameras and other tools also used in law enforcement that are already very prevalent in schools and very part of academic, checking for academic integrity. And at some point, I suppose I can hear the argument of like, the people who use these AI detectors, I think, often argue that like you just can't just total trust because at stake is learning, right? Maybe we should mention that for a minute, like. Why is it important that the student do their own work? I'm sure you have a spiel you've told students, but like, what is, why do you think it's so important that it might need to be checked?
Yeah, I mean, on a very simplistic level, you've got to be able to break down a big problem in your brain and critically think about how to solve a problem, whether it's writing an essay or producing a lab report. You've got to think about how to organize information and put it in the right sequence in order to be persuasive or convincing. In that sense, they obviously, they need to do their own work. Now, the question of what they're going to need to know how to do in the future is a whole separate question. And that's where we get into rethinking assessments, which is another big topic that I and other people, a lot of people, I'm sure you are thinking about a lot. Like, how do we need to change assessments to reflect the world that our students are going to be living in? And one of those facts of life, I do believe, is that written communication, I don't want to say that it's going to be devalued, because I don't believe that. But the ability to communicate in a written format is going to drop in value in terms of the skills you can have when you get out into the world. I think that's a fact. It may be a depressing fact, but I think it's a fact.
It is a little bit depressing to me personally, as somebody who writes for a living, but I hear you. In other words, it's just because there will be this tool that makes it easier for anybody, despite their training, to generate clean text in some formatted way.
Right. And so, long term, we need to rethink our what we're actually assessing and how we generate critical thinking activities and experiences for kids. And I have, ways I'm thinking about doing that. And I actually think about the linguistic fingerprinting. I think I wrote this in the blog that you mentioned on the Substack. I view it as a transition phase thing. Like, I don't see this as a long-term solution at all. I just think of it, it's going to take us a while as an industry and as teachers to figure out what the new assessment framework needs to look like and actually implement it. I mean, we're talking years, I think. And in the interim, we're going to need something that keeps people feeling like they have some way of identifying what kids are producing, until we can, again, reformat those assessment methods so that we are continuing to, kids are doing their own work. Maybe using AI alongside it, but still thinking. And I mean, what happens when we stop thinking? What happens when everybody stops thinking? I don't know. It's an ugly. It's not a thought I want to dwell on for too long.
Sure. No, so it's good to remember the stakes, but so you have mentioned you have tried this linguistic fingerprinting in your own classes, and it sounds like there was even a time where it came in handy to have knowing that you had this as a backup. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a perfect example of the value of the tool because in our case, the freshman science teacher came to me and said, hey, we got a student who produced a piece of writing that really doesn't sound like him. Do you have any other pieces of writing so that I can compare and make sure that I'm not, accusing him of something when he doesn't deserve it? And I said, yeah, sure. And then I took a look at it, and it was pretty clear to me that it wasn't his writing. And I said, listen, and he said, I don't know how, his family's going to react. I don't know what this is going to be like. And I said, well, listen, I've got this backup tool we can use to really, ensure that we have some sort of evidence, some sort of data rather than just the eye test, right? No student wants a teacher to be like, this just doesn't sound like you. Well, it was me, you know what I mean? And that can get very personal and offensive very quickly. So in any case, we ran it through and produced a report. The report confirmed what we thought, that it was unlikely to have been written by that student. The biology teacher went to the mother and said, hey, you didn't even have to use the report. But the mother said, yeah, it turned out his mom wrote it for him, more or less.
Wow. So the mother fessed up that this wasn't the student's work. It was mom's.
Exactly. And so this fear that it was AI or whatever, we were able to find out the truth. And it was not that intrusive or anything like that. But the truth was just that he didn't write it, right? It wasn't that AI wrote it.
That was the relevant truth here. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. And that situation turned out, it was a very clean situation. She said, okay, I won't, I'm not going to help him to that level anymore. I'm not going to, he needs to write for himself. But that happens all the time anyway. And so it's not an uncommon thing for teachers to have happen. And it was a nice light bulb moment. This does work, right? And it's not trying to detect AI. It's just detecting whether or not the kid wrote it. So.
Right. And I think that is an interesting example that predates AI again of, an age old issue of like, is this a student's work? That's really what's at stake in the question.
That's what we care about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in some ways that gets back to, rather than this tool game of cat and mouse, you're really just trying to get at that, have some sort of system. And I think it's interesting that you didn't actually have to use it, but it did give you some sort of confidence. Is that right? That going into that encounter with the parent, because you didn't know how it was going to go down.
I know it gave me confidence. And I think, I think it gave the biology teacher some confidence too. Okay, I've got this at my back if I need it. But I'm, of course, like I said, last line of defense, not first line of defense. You don't, slap a 20-page report in front of a kid and his parent and say, look what you did. You just have the conversation first. And then if it really gets there, then you can go, listen, it's not just me, right? We've got this tool and we compared it and it really doesn't look like him. So it's a peace of mind thing. It's a peace of mind thing. And it's a last line of defense in the event that things do get tense or difficult to navigate, I guess.
No, and I think I've heard that this is the way people have used the Turnitin and other plagiarism detection software for years, even before generative AI was a discussion of like, it was just, everyone knew, the students knew that this was a tool that the school bought. And so you may not even know if your individual teacher used it or not, but you knew that it was possible to be checked against the internet. And so it was, I think, a deterrent slash some sort of feeling that the teacher had of like, okay, there's some system I could turn to if there's questions that come up.
Exactly. And it might only go that far. It might just be this sort of, floating sort of deterrent, like you said, that kids are aware of. If and when, I think kids don't really know right now what's real and what's not. Can AI detection work? Can it not? But if and when kids start saying, hey, you can't use AI detection because it doesn't work. Well, you've got this and you let them know, hey, we do have a way, just so we do have a way. And that sometimes that's all a kid needs is just knowing that he or she is going to be held accountable. Kids want to do the right thing. They procrastinate and they make some poor choices often when they are up against the gun and they got 10 minutes until they finish an assignment or something like that. But if there's enough of a deterrent built into the system, then they're gonna think ahead and they're gonna plan out because they're gonna go, I can't leave it till the last minute. I will get, for lack of a better word, caught.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting. Another thing that you wrote that I was really intrigued by is that here we're talking about this very kind of cut black and white situation. I think a lot of teachers assume when they hear this topic of like, either, you know, don't use AI, is it the student's totally own work? But you're imagining a world in which a teacher might even allow some use of AI. And this tool could help. This fingerprinting, linguistic fingerprinting could help. Explain what you mean there, you know?
Yeah, I think it could fit in. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I think it could fit in. Something that I did recently, this is about a month or two ago, I actually put a project-based learning menu in front of my students when we finished reading Romeo and Juliet. And I said, you know, you've got this huge menu to choose from. You can make almost anything you want, right? Free reign. My rubric is going to be very broad. I'm just looking for creativity. I'm looking for evidence. You understand the book, et cetera, the things we always look for. But I'm not going to be prescriptive about what you make and what you try to achieve. Here's the kicker. When you start, you get to use ChatGPT as a brainstorm and an outlining and a problem-solving assistant. And then I told them here, but here's the other kicker. I'm going to actually monitor and assess and evaluate your use of ChatGPT. So you're going to share the chat with me and I'm going to grade, you know, whether or not you were thoughtful about the way you use ChatGPT, whether or not you were creative, whether or not you thought critically about what it was producing, et cetera, et cetera. But my point is that this was a framework, a possible framework where kids can use AI to like broaden the possibilities of what they can create or achieve. And there's a level of monitoring and assessing to the point that in the end, if they do produce an essay, you know, I saw their chat, right? I saw the chat at the beginning, so I know what it produced for them. And then at the end, if the end is so broadly different from what they had in the chat, then I've got an indication that something's maybe up, something's maybe awry, right? And in that situation, they go, well, you said I could use it. And I, well, you were only supposed to use it for this. And, you know, again, first couple of lines of defense are in our normal teaching strategies. But on the back end, if they're like, no, I didn't use it for revisions. I didn't use it for editing. You know, the teacher said you can use it for brainstorming, but not for revision. And then maybe they did, right? Then you, again, you've got this percentage likelihood that the writing itself was done by the student, if that's what you're aiming to achieve. So it's complicated. It's a framework I'm still working on. But yes, I do think it fits into that world.
I think you're forgiven for having only tried one experiment, not all the possible experiments that since this technology is only a little more than a year old as far as a product commodity. So you mentioned other people have pointed out critiques. Like, what's the strongest critique out there that you have heard to the fingerprinting idea, the linguistic fingerprints?
You know, some people point out, they say, well, a kid's writing should change throughout the course of the year. You know, I don't want the writing to sound and look the same in 8 months than it did at the beginning. And my response to that is twofold. One, you know, if you've ever taught middle school writing, which I have, if you taught early high school writing, their writing does not change that much in 8 months. Yes, it improves, hopefully. Yes, it gets better. But we are talking about a very sophisticated algorithm that, you know, I'm sure there's some great writing teachers out there, but it's not going to change that much in 8 months.
If you're not that good of a writing teacher. That's
well, as a writing teacher myself, on my best day, I couldn't get a kid to a point where he's fooling this algorithm. And then the other point I would say is, if you want to redo it after 6 months, if you want to redo it in January and get a new known document, great. You know, and that's not that hard. Again, it's just one class period, and you're going to have them do some writing anyway, right? So just monitor their screens, have them do one in September and in January or whatever. And you've got two known documents and you've got something to make you feel like you can trust the kids, you know? Oh, actually, sorry. Here's one other argument. That's a guy named Lance Eaton, who's a really smart guy. He posted this on the blog itself as a comment. I've been meaning to respond to it. He said, well, yeah, you know, the fingerprinting would definitely work really well with someone like J.K. Rowling or James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Ted Kaczynski, who wrote a ton, and they were also adults, and their writing style was more or less static at that point. But what happens when you've only, is it really fair to use just one known document? I think that's actually a really strong counter argument to using it, because, you know, like my students said, they said, well, what if I write differently on this next paper? That's not fair, you know? So yeah, I guess if you had a larger lexicon, if you had a larger sample size, you could feel more trusting of it. But yeah, that's one other counter argument.
It's super, super interesting to me. You also said something I wanted to follow up on, which is that students are exposed to ChatGPT and generative AI all over the place these days. You mentioned, I think, Snapchat, and there's some famously well-used by young people apps, entertainment apps that now incorporate it. And so it sounds like you're saying attitudes about whether it's okay to use AI to express yourself are changing. Is that, tell me a little bit more about what you mean, you know, and what is the change you're seeing?
The general side, I think you can broaden out and you can talk about adults. And, you know, what I see happening, and I'm doing it in my own world. You know, I write for myself and my blog, and I try to write a lot. I use AI. I use ChatGPT. I ask it, sometimes I need help with a particular paragraph. I just can't get the words to fit the way I want them to, or I need help brainstorming a couple of ideas, like things I know they're in somewhere in the back of my mind. I just can't pull them up to the front. ChatGPT has been a really, really helpful tool for that. And I've noticed that, you know, not just colleagues, but friends, family members, just people that I talk to about it in general are kind of moving past. I kind of think about it in terms of the five stages of grief. You know, I think in a way we're kind of grieving the loss of the old way of doing things. And that's a real process. It's something that we all need to go through for sure. In my opinion, it's not something to dismiss, but I see people moving past, whether it's anger or fear or bargaining or depression, and getting to a point of going, okay, this is the world I live in. Let me try this thing out. Let me see if it can help me. Let me see how it can help me. And let me see what I need to know. And so I see that kind of happening on an adult level first. And then on the schoolwork side, you know, the dangerous part is that kids don't know they're using ChatGPT when they're using Snapchat AI. And I think there's a lot of people just in general, adults, who don't necessarily understand that. You know, ChatGPT, Claude, and Gemini are essentially engines inside of a car. And then everything else are just the different cars you can buy when you go to the used car lot. Are you going to get a Ferrari? Are you going to get a convertible? Or are you going to get an SUV? Are you going to get a minivan? Are you going to get a coupe? That's what's happening when you're choosing between Snapchat or Instagram, or, you know, the plethora of educational tools that are out there right now using AI. You're really just using ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini. And those are the engines, right? They're the engines inside the car. And it worries me a lot because kids say to me things like, no, I didn't use ChatGPT. And then I'll find out later, they're like, yeah, but I use Snapchat. And I go, oh man, you know, how do I even unpack this? How do I unravel this to get you to understand that you're, yeah, go ahead.
No, and what is, so tell us who don't use Snapchat, remind us, what does this Snapchat tool do?
Yeah. So I haven't actually used it myself. I've only seen kids use it. But there's a way for Snapchat will allow you to like take pictures of homework or whatever, and it will either summarize or it will translate if you're doing Spanish class, for example, or if it's a math problem, it could, I think, give you the answer. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it can help you find the answer or even give it to you. It can write things for you. So it can do all of those, basically the same things that ChatGPT can do, not only right on your phone, but within a social media app that you're using all the time anyway. And that's where it gets really frightening. And that's why I think I said earlier that for me, at least in the context of my school, I kind of think that next year, you know, we haven't had a huge problem with it this year. We've had some examples, you know, some moments where we've caught it, and kids are probably using it a lot more than we know. But I think next year, when you get a new set of students and you don't have the baseline understanding of where their work is at, you as a teacher are going to be like constantly questioning, what am I reading? Is this them? I don't know. I can't tell. And so I do think that this sort of problem is going to get really, really big. And just to go back to your original question about sort of accepted adoption, I think kids were really afraid in August and September when I talked to them about it. They were like, oh, no, I don't use AI. And now I hear them, and some of them are comfortable enough with me to tell me they use it, and my friends use it, and we all use it. And so that's, you know, they are now comfortable with it. I don't know what happened. I don't know how it became that way, but they are much more comfortable with it than they were 7 months ago.
Is it possible that some of the students, and I genuinely don't, I'm not trying to lead you either way. I really don't know. Like, is it possible that some of those students are actually doing plenty of thinking and processing on their own, and using it is different for them than what you would think of as a teacher of cheating? What do you suspect, knowing these individuals that you're talking to?
It's absolutely possible, but you don't know, and that uncertainty is, I think, a bigger, you know, that uncertainty, I fear, is going to break down trust in the classroom. And to me, that's how the house of cards falls down, because any teacher, any classroom teacher can tell you that it's a delicate balance. Classroom management is a delicate balance. You're always managing kids' emotions and where they're at that day, and your own emotions too. And you're trying to develop trust and maintain trust and foster trust and make sure that it, this very, very delicate, beautiful, important thing doesn't fall to the ground and smash into a million pieces. And I think when you don't know and you wonder every time you get an assignment submitted, is my student conning me, for lack of a better word, right? Or are they using it more than they should, maybe, to put it in a more, in a more optimistic, nicer way? Then you have teachers who are, they're going to feel like they can't trust their students. And then you get into a he said, she said, or you get a finger pointing and a blaming situation, and trust just shatters. And so my fear is less about, I think the critical thinking stuff that we've been talking about, like kids need to do their own work because they need to be able to think and communicate on their own. Absolutely. Right. But a more pressing issue is what happens next fall when teachers have new students and they don't know if they can trust their own students.
Yeah. And that trust is more, so it's even more than just the academic integrity somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of like what I was saying to you before, where, yeah, I can go to a student now and they'll, because we've been together for 7 months or 8 months, you know, because we've had our ups and downs, because we've, you know, I've had to maybe discipline, and I've also given them a reward or been like, yeah, great job, you know? So they know that both are coming. They know that both exist, I think. And so you trust each other and you feel like, I'm not going to like crush this kid because he or she is being honest with me right now. He or she is telling me the truth, and I know I can trust them. And how do you build trust, right? That's what those first 3 months of school are all about, is, you know, building in your system of accountabilities, of accountability in the classroom, building in your reward system, your incentive system, your consequence system, all of those things. How do you do that when the academic work that's being submitted is, who knows, right? It's a giant question mark. So yeah, trust could be at risk, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it goes back to why you wouldn't necessarily come right in with that 30-page document being like, you're busted.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. They're going to feel like they're being cross-examined. They're going to feel like they might as well.
Light is shining directly. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Like the movie scene, like, you know, and you would never want to do that. And every teacher knows that. Every adult, every parent knows that, right? You just, that's just not how you handle that situation. I don't know what else you do. You know, I don't know how else you navigate next fall. And that's why I did a lot of the experiments that I did this year, because I want to be able to speak with some degree of functional literacy to my kids next year. And I want to be able to say, okay, you know, here's what I'm comfortable with. Here's what I'm not comfortable with. I know you guys are probably using it at home all the time. Let's strike a deal, right? I want to be able to meet them halfway with a reasonable degree of fluency or literacy in the technology itself.
How optimistic are you that this and other approaches that you're experimenting with can get you there and you can pull this off, you know, next academic year?
So I think we're in for a very bumpy next 5 years or so, maybe even longer. I think it's going to be a really, really bumpy couple of years. My big thing is that I think the Department of Education or local governments need to establish AI literacy as a core competency in schools. And I'm not the only one that's saying that. A lot of people are saying it.
We did an episode on this. People can go listen to it for sure.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And, but I, you know, the wheels of bureaucracy move incredibly slowly. And so long term, my optimism lies there. If we can change our assessment strategies and change what we care about kids producing and acknowledge that written work really isn't going to be it anymore. You know, my new thing also is verbal communication. So when a kid finishes an essay, I more or less, I haven't done this every single time, but I'm doing it a lot more now where I'm saying, all right, everybody's going to go up without their paper and just talk about their argument for 3 to 5 minutes, whatever it may be. And your job is to verbally communicate what you were trying to prove, how you went about proving it, you know, what your argument was, because that's something AI can't do, right? And so my optimism lies in, you know, rethinking assessment strategies like that, making AI literacy incredibly important, because Lord, if they don't know what they're working with, I really worry. But those are both long-term things. So, you know, I can't say better than a 50-50 shot on those things, to be honest.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all this with us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
This has been the EdSurge podcast. This is what we do here every week. We dig into big new issues facing education. If you like this, please tell a friend. And if you want to support the show, please take a minute to leave a rating or a review on whatever app you're listening to right now. We hope you'll also subscribe to our EdSurge podcast newsletter or any of the newsletters we publish here at EdSurge. You can find them at edsurge.com. This episode was put together by me, Jeff Young. You can find me online at jeffyoung.net or on X at jryoung. Editing assistance this week by Rebecca Koenig and music by Komaku. We'll be back next week with more on the future of learning. Thanks for listening.